Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our endless exploration of the cultures of consciousness. Just the other night here at the lovely Rice campus in Houston, Texas, the music school, which is actually very good and has lots of excellent concerts, performed Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which you probably better know as the really impressive music in 2001. And while I was too lazy to actually make the concert, even though it was free, it did not prevent me from thinking about 2001, A Space Odyssey, and one of my favorite stories about watching movies. And it's a story by a friend of mine who also happens to be a scholar of the Mithraic Mysteries, which will come up again in this hour. And he was, you know, it was in the 60s, and he was ahead, and I think he probably was in an altered state of some sort or another. I can't speak for that, but his name is Dave. And so at one point in the movie, when Hal is talking to Dave Bowman, he's saying, you know, Dave, I can't do that. My friend starts to believe that the film is actually directed about him, and that Hal is the rational part of his mind, and that Dave is this sort of spiritual seeker. And so the last like quarter of the film was basically a theophany or a kind of a ritual initiation that occurred to my friend through the medium of watching this film. And of course, at the end, with all the crazy graphics, which looked really crazy in the 60s, his mind was completely blown. And he said he walked around for about 3 days afterwards in a state of grace, where he was like communicating, he felt like he was communicating holy information, and people were like, "Wow, you're so clear, everything is makes sense," and then it kind of went away. But I love that story because it represents this weird secret potential in popular culture that's always fascinated me. The sense that if you just look at it the right way, or you experience it in just the right state of mind, it can have the force of revelation, the force of an esoteric mystery exposed. Of course, and that does happen. It can be, music can be revelatory. Concerts can change your life, can change the way you feel yourself, etc. But there's something more specific about like a particular mystery being expressed through particularly music, but, you know, films as well, popular films, pulp novels, etc., etc. And once you start tuning into this world, it makes me think of Philip K. Dick's famous line that the symbols of the divine initially show up at the trash stratum, in the trash stratum. And by trash, he also meant trashy popular culture, like the kind of books he wrote, which also have, you know, divine symbols in them. So there's this sense for the kind of transformative possibilities for popular culture that really inspired me. My book about Led Zeppelin IV came totally out of that sense of like, let's see how far you can push it. Let's see how many mysteries and occult secrets you can squeeze out of some piece of mass consumer popular culture. And that was really what drove me in that book. And it also is very much one of the life motivations of our guest today, Chris Knowles, who runs an amazing blog called The Secret Sun, where he tracks the mysteries literally scattered and across the landscape of popular culture. And he's written a couple of books, including The Secret History of Rock and Roll, which is what we're going to be talking about today, how the mystery religions help us understand and appreciate what went on with the great rock and roll explosion for the last 30, 40 years. And anyway, so he does a remarkable job precisely of weaving together popular culture and the mysteries. Like just the most recent entry on The Secret Sun, you know, so it's totally typical for the blog. Some reader points him to some incredibly obscure piece of media, which is this like short-lived TV show from the early 80s called The Phoenix. And you look at the graphics and it completely blows your mind. It's so cheesy and so divine at the same time. And then he starts to analyze all the little bits of data, the dates, the names, exactly what's going on. And then as you read it, it starts to seem more and more like this isn't just some random piece of pop media, but actually it's signifying some deeper mystery, something about the transformation of consciousness or the upwelling of Jungian archetypes or the mysterious forces that are controlling the signs that organize our sense of daily reality. And it's just a wonderful, it's a wonderful experience. It's a time-honored tradition that goes well back to the 1960s and the pranksters of the Principia Discordia and Robert Anton Wilson and a whole way of like tweaking popular culture as a sort of psychedelic mystery narrative. So we'll be bringing on Chris in just a bit, but we will be talking a lot as well about the mystery traditions of the ancient pagan mystery cults that really came into their prime at the end of the ancient world, around the time of Christ, and running over the next couple of centuries until Rome went to Jesus. And it remains a totally fascinating part of human history. The mystery religions are some of the most interesting things, I think, to study in the ancient world, and full of images and ideas that feed into our own experience today in ways that we'll talk about. Before we bring Chris on, I'd like to introduce, of course, Expanding Minds co-host, the lovely Maja Dau, White Witch of L.A. How are you doing, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. So I know there's lots of mystery religions, and I know you know a lot about these lots of mystery religions, but what is your favorite mystery religion of the ancient world?
Ooh, making me pick favorites.
Yeah.
Well, I have been totally
immersed
in one of the mystery traditions right now, just because I've been preparing for this solstice ritual that I'm going to do, and it kind of started out where I was looking into like the mistletoe ritual of the Druids, so I was getting like into the Druids, but it kept coming back to the bull. So I like had all these crazy synchronicities in my research and kept coming back to the bull, and so I've been totally into the Apis mystery tradition, which is tied in with Osiris and, you know, Isis, and it like penetrates so many different ones. So I've been really down with the bull. The white bull has been like penetrating everything and getting into all of my stuff. So it's been like this combination of a kind of obsession with the bull mysteries, and then it's like coming into everything in a really weird way. So the bull mystery is like they do dismemberment because you sacrifice him. But the crazy thing about the bull is that it's the only animal that can actually be the god. Like a lot of other animals that you see used for sacrifice and stuff like that, they're put in the god's place. But the bull mystery is one of the most like esoteric because the bull can actually take on the god itself. Like God can manifest in the bull, whereas a lot of the other kind of animal mysteries, it's like a substitute, like a scapegoat.
Wow, that is most intriguing. But I'm also intrigued by the way you mentioned the sort of synchronicities in your research, and that's really the kind of thing that I think inspires Chris as well, the way you dive into this stuff and all the connections start to fire up. So with no further ado, I'd like to welcome Christopher Knowles to Expanding Mind. How's it going, Chris?
It's going great, Eric. How you doing?
Great, great. Thanks so much for joining us today, man. It's really a treat to have you on the show, and also just to celebrate your book, The Secret History of Rock and Roll, which is almost kind of two books. It's kind of a book about rock and roll, and you are a huge fan and have written extensively on rock lore and have a vast love of the music. And so, in part, it's a tribute to that. To that world, but it's also very much a book about the mystery religions, and you really start out and spend the first big chunk of the text talking about the mystery religions. You know, in all of your various studies or whatever, what kept you coming back to this period of time? And even tell us maybe a little bit more about what are these things when we say mystery religion? What are we talking about?
Basically, the mystery religions grew out as a reaction to the state cults, you know, the formalized, ritualized state cults. And, you know, I guess in Greece you would have Zeus and Hera. and then Jupiter or Amun in Egypt. Basically what these were is that this became the establishment. This became about priestcraft. This became about politics and, you know, basically a giant kind of pageant. The mystery cults were not necessarily pagan. They were what's called henotheistic. And henotheistic is when you choose a god from the pantheon as your personal savior god, that this god is the one that you choose to form this very deep relationship with. And the mystery traditions themselves go back a very, very long way to the Stone Age, as far as most people can tell. But it all has to do with fertility, the cycles of nature, and how that corresponds to the cycles of life. But really, the secret behind all of this, and something that a lot of scholars are not entirely comfortable coming to grips with, is the whole hallucinogenic, psychedelic, and entheogenic aspect of the mysteries. And I think that's really probably what drew me to them over the years, is because I was so fascinated by that period in the mid-60s, that utopian psychedelic period, sort of pre-Summer of Love in a way. But, you know, where things sort of coalesced and you had all these memes sort of bubbling up from the collective unconscious. And there were so many different influences that were feeding into that. But it was this tapping in, you know, using these tools to really tap into the deepest recesses of, you know, the cultural DNA, the neural DNA. And this is something that we saw pop up, you know, maybe with the cyberpunks and the Kalima movement in the 70s in New York. You know, there's always been sorts of aftershocks, I guess, from the pre-Summer of Love 60s. But it all has these through lines, these continuities that go all the way back. And when you start to read the descriptions of the mysteries and the descriptions of the rituals, it really becomes very familiar to you. You know, it seems that what happened in the 60s and the aftershocks thereof was really a return rather than an innovation. You know, it wasn't a sort of radical, new, mutant culture that grew up out of consumer capitalism. It was a return to really experiential religion, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, at the time, of course, you know, there's a lot of this, you know, the upwelling of the counterculture and of rock and roll, and it's, you know, more aggressive, intense, psychedelic, electrified sense. You know, at the time, people would you know, describe it as being Dionysian, for example, but they kind of meant it in a really sort of vague way, that it was, you know, party forward, or you know, that it had a kind of chaotic element or an element of noise and darkness, as well as sort of the more light-filled ecstasies that you could associate, let's say, with gospel music in American you know, history, which also has an ecstatic character, but is clearly on, you know, the light side of the fence. And instead, people are, oh, well, that's Dionysian. But what you're talking about really is that the more you know about what that means, you know, what that Dionysus wasn't just a god of partying, but was associated with his own particular cults, and that they were in a period where there were a lot of these groups that were focused on initiatory, ecstatic experiences that often had a sort of underground quality that involved some kind of secrecy, but also very much an experiential domain, really help us understand what happens with popular culture, particularly popular cultures that emphasize ecstatic transformation and intensity and vision and a lot of the things that that you find with the 60s groups. But I'll ask you too, like, what is it about which of the mysteries really kind of seem to intrigue you the most, or the ones that struck you as you did your research that really had remarkable elements, maybe because they connected with these currents that later appear in the 60s, or for other reasons? Like, what really stuck with you?
Well, what I write about in the introduction to the book is that the Mithraic mysteries of the late Roman period seemed the most familiar to me because I had been involved in the hardcore punk scene, which are really up and down, you know, once you strip away all the cultural contaminants, are Mithraic to the core. It's really, you know, about hyper-masculine aggression as you know, almost as a means of transcendental experience. That it's about moral Puritanism. It's about speaking secretly, you know, expressing yourself in ways, you know, designed to not only confound the unbeliever, but to alienate them. And that, all of that was so recognizable to me, you know, the violent iconography, you know, and the symbolism. And the interesting thing about this is that there are so many different tributaries that run out to this, but Jung really saw the Mithraic liturgy as his doorway into this mystery realm. But at the same time, you have this continuity that there are these groups, the whether they're called the Korybantes or the Kurites or the Dactyls, these basically heavy metal bands, which is really fascinating. This goes all the way back to the mysteries of Samothrace and beyond, back to Phrygia, that they would perform at all these different mystery religions, these rituals. So there's a lot of continuities between them. They're not as different as they might appear on the surface, and that people would practice many different mystery religions because they saw it all as part of a continuity. And for instance, I mean, Mithras really ties into both these opposing poles of Apollo and Hercules, you know, these solar savior figures. Dionysus is sort of he's the doorway, he's the bridge between the more feminine mysteries of Isis and Demeter, who really come to be seen as the same figure. But Dionysus is very much identified with figures like Attis and Adonis, these sort of gender-bending, basically what they are is that they're sort of a mediator between these opposing poles of the psyche, between the anima and the animus, with Demeter and Cybele are on that far, that very matronly earth mother kind of expression, and then Mithras is all about the solar energy, the hyper-masculine energy, and this ties into figures like Horus, and again Hercules, who had his own mysteries, who had his own cults. And then Apollo, and Apollo is a very interesting figure because he's very much a part of that state system, but he's also not part of it. He has his purpose, his purpose as being part of the officialdom of the state religion, but also the oracles, you know, these ecstatic, hallucinogenic rituals of the priestesses who go into these frenzied states where they then become prophetesses, and the sibyls. I mean, it does.
Yeah, Apollo's a really interesting figure because, you know, when you kind of go through typical humanities education, you know, they'll tell you like the Apollo Dionysus polarity, you know, like made famous by Nietzsche. But it's a really good way to look at a lot of art stuff. But then the more you find out about Apollo, the more you realize that he's a lot more complex figure. Dionysus too, but in some ways less. Like Apollo is really a rich one. But the way you're talking about this reminded me of something else, and I know this is something that interests you as well. Is just the way that when you start to get into figuring out who these gods are, immediately you start to see the way that they're kind of transformations of other gods, they're recombinations of other gods. And in fact, that whole polytheistic world doesn't mean that people necessarily worship multiple gods, although they often did, but that world of late antiquity was this almost like kind of mix and match world. I mean, some gods were actually created intentionally, like Serapis was created intentionally to like balance between the Greeks and the Egyptians and Alexandria. So they said, hey, let's take a little bit of Osiris over here and a little bit of this guy over there,
Eric,
and put them together.
Serapis
so it's really a very it's
Serapis
a very imaginative
a
world because of that recombination.
Yeah, she was saying about the bull. And that ties in Serapis to Dionysus, but Osiris and Dionysus.
And to Mithra also, because Mithra slays and dismembers the bull as well.
Yeah, I see, this is where I think the dirty secrets of history sort of come out, because, of course, a lot of these entheogenic compounds, these funguses grew, where bulls were known to
that's right.
to congregate. I think that there was in history, maybe in the shamanic period, sort of the pre-pagan period almost, where you get into this raw, animistic, shamanic expression, that the bull is seen as producing these compounds, producing these mushrooms, that it's something that comes out of him.
Chimpanzees grow in their dung,
Well, that's exactly right, and that's why the Egyptians had the sun beetle, because the dung beetle, because again, it's associated with that. It's funny how these associations, are things that we would sort of not want to associate ourselves with today, but we're very much part of this shamanic period where the cycles of life, where nothing would be wasted, that everything is recycled, that excrement becomes fertilizer, that everything is part of this much closer, more on the edge experience of nature. And with the Greeks are the first people who really try to consciously separate themselves from nature. And I think this is really where Dionysus comes out, because Dionysus starts off as this pudgy, bearded, sort of bon vivant character who's very much a part of the Greek civilized, the whole thing with the philosophers sitting around and drinking wine and trading theories and stuff. But he very quickly evolves. He's taken over by the repressed women of Greek society, and he becomes this much more complex and fascinating and violent and multifaceted character. Of course, the problem with Dionysus and this Dionysus expression is that it very easily degenerates into hedonism, into just frenzy for frenzy's sake. So I think the interesting thing about a lot of these traditions, and I think you see in a lot of the writings, and this is why these people were so disciplined about this, they understood how quickly this could degenerate. And I've actually read one historian who said that he believed that the whole mystery tradition was about avoiding bad trips. The whole preparation was really so you have a good trip, so you meet the god. And we see this in the Golden Ass when Lucius meets Isis, with this beautiful starlit sort of presentation that he experiences. And of course, this is all very familiar to people who have experience with psychedelia and entheogens, whether directly or through the literature.
Well, it's when you talk about the chaos, the chaos, the frenzy for frenzy's sake, it just immediately raises these questions about, the 60s when we look at them in hindsight, particularly, however much I'm attracted or fascinated by Dionysian experience and by exploring the body and the mind through, states of altered consciousness and, experiences of intensity through music and through group behavior, et cetera, et cetera. You can also just look at a lot of the stuff that happens, and it's in retrospect, you're like, well, that looks a little cheesy. It's a little over the top, and it hurt a lot of people too. So it's interesting that in a way, you could say that the what the mystery traditions did or tried to do, or, and this is speculative, but it makes sense, is that it had to do with conjuring those kind of raw energies, but in a framework that increased the odds that it was going to be a good experience, or increased the sense that the initiatory blast was going to be coherent and the frenzy was going to take you somewhere rather than simply dismantle your ordinary worldview.
Well, really, the whole purpose of this was to deliver the initiate from the terror of death. And this is very much a part of the literature from Eleusis and whatnot. But if you're looking for parallels today, more direct parallels, not so much what I talk about in The Secret History of Rock and Roll. The more direct parallels, I think, are voodoo, Santeria, and also the mushroom cults and the shamans of Central and South America, that they are very much, the whole discipline and sort of rigor that we see, applied to these experiences is very much in toto with the mystery traditions. That, asceticism and things like this, celibacy, it was all sort of about clearing the psyche, you know, clearing the psyche of, there was confession of sins, things like that. It would all be so you wouldn't have these things weighing down on you. You know, it wasn't just the hallucinogens. It was also, you know, what we see in a much different context in the real Dionysian mysteries of today, which is Pentecostalism and charismatic Christianity. You know, the parallels there are just astounding. But to me, again, when I look at those traditions, I see that same degenerative potentiality that we saw in the Dionysian mysteries. The Dionysian mysteries really had a very bad habit of going awry, that, you know, it was meant to celebrate the seasons, and then it became, you know, every weekend, you know, every Friday night or whatever, there would be these blowouts. And it really did, when you read a lot of literature, not only from people like Livy, who are, you know, conservative Roman followers of Jupiter and the state, but, you know, there is this sense that there was this misdirection, I think, of energy that is inherent in Dionysus. And maybe that, when we tie into the Orphic mysteries and how they explain that Dionysus is part god, part, you know, Zeus of Olympus, but also part Titan, that there's this destructive and savage aspect to this god. And it's interesting how this sort of, when we saw this in True Blood, I don't know if you guys ever watched that show, but they had this whole storyline that was like straight out of the ancient mysteries, that there was an ancient maenad who comes to Bon Ton, and she initiates everybody into the mysteries of Dionysus and this whole appearance of the bull and whatnot. But I thought it was very canny, because it really kind of showed that there is this very sharp double edge to this god, and maybe so much that tapping into that Dionysian energy is really, I think, what kind of derailed the counterculture in the 60s. You know, I sort of see, and maybe a lot of people disagree with me, but I really see that this all went awry, starting in 67, and this is why we saw, you know, the Diggers have the Death of Hippie and all these sort of things, that a lot of the people who are originally tuned into the movement start leaving San Francisco, they start leaving downtown Los Angeles. You know, that they really see this as being hijacked. And I think that not only did things go awry as far as self-discipline that we saw in the mysteries, that we see in you know, more serious expressions of Santeria and whatnot, but it was also made it much more easy for the enemies of counterculture to not only use them as, you know, a negative example. You know, Charlie Manson is the best, you know, avatar of this. But it's very easy for things to get derailed, you know, where LSD and mushrooms start getting replaced by STP and angel dust and hair. You know what I'm saying? It's that whole degenerative thing that when you tap into that Dionysian expression, kind of sort of takes things off the rails.
Yeah, word to the wise. Well, we got a lot of, you brought up a lot of interesting stuff there. I definitely want to ask you about your take on Pentecostalism, but we're going to take a break right now. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Christopher Knowles, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Radio Network celebrating 5 years of independent news.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Masa Dawu here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Christopher Knowles about his new book, The Secret History of Rock and Roll, which brings up the mystery traditions. And Christopher, you have brought up something that I thought was very interesting. You mentioned how the mystery traditions in Dionysus can kind of work towards resolving the terror of death. And I thought that was so interesting just because so many musicians in rock and roll who, you know, delve into the Dionysian mysteries do meet their end, in fact, by that same means. And I always thought, like, with musicians, like I would listen to, you know, Charlie Parker or John Coltrane, and I would always marvel that they could be on so many drugs and yet be able to go right into that kind of ecstatic religious state. And there's so many rock and rollers that seem to be able to skate that line where they can delve into the ecstatic state of mystery with all of these substances, whereas, you know, most people would just, like you said, go into the hedonistic part and just kind of completely unravel, which certainly happened to many people. What do you think is that missing ingredient which allowed so many musicians in rock and roll to really be able to take on that ecstatic experience and be in that moment?
Well, it's interesting because there were the muses. When you talk, you know, polytheism can get very confusing. There's so many things that you sort of get tossed into the mix here. But the music itself, I mean, I personally see it this way, and I think a lot of people who have played music and have worked with music do as well, is that it's very much its own power. And it's very much something that you serve, that you become the vessel for. And for some strange reason, throughout history, music has chosen broken vessels to express itself through. I'm not quite sure why. This might tie us more into the mysteries of Orpheus, of course, related again in many ways to the mysteries of Dionysus. But again, there's this continuity, there's this continuum that all these gods can be placed on. But it seems to me that music has its own imperative, that it's going to express itself in ways that it sees fit. When I was playing music, I could never write a song. I had to wait for a song to be written through me. And I'm sure that, you know, most musicians will tell you the same thing. And I could always tell, listening to the radio, especially nowadays, particularly nowadays, that the songs are there's too much effort involved. There's too much of an intrusion on this process where music, or the muses, if you prefer, is speaking through the artist, that you impose your own will on that. And the interesting thing when you mention people like Charlie Parker or Miles Davis, a lot of these guys who had like really deep-seated issues with addiction and whatnot, maybe that made them more suitable. It sort of broke down the ego. It broke down their sense of maybe even their sense of self. And of course, this can be a very dangerous process, as we've seen in history. But it's surrendering something, however you want to see it, however you choose to couch it, whether you want to couch it in strictly neurological terms or in psychological terms or in spiritual terms. It's basically something that we can recognize throughout history that we can see objectively as a surrender to a more powerful force than the conscious ego.
Yeah, and I think if you're somebody who has that tendency, you know, and a lot of artists are going to, one of the ways to define them is that they're more open to more spontaneous or irrational or dreamlike or other states of mind. I mean, even artists who are very controlled and clever and intellectual in their approach, there's a part of their process where they've got to be open to something that most people in society don't need to be. If you have that tendency, whether it's psychological or spiritual, however you want to characterize it, you're going to be a little alienated as well. And, so you're going to find certain behaviors and things that are associated with just the fact of being alienated in a society that needs the muses still, but it's lost a way of thinking about them that in a probably maybe in a more balanced way. It's hard to say. But it's certainly lost a way of really understanding the processes of creativity, even as it still requires, feeds off of creative work.
Well, the legendary A&R guy named John Kalodner, who said that antidepressants killed rock and roll. He said that what made rock and roll so great was the personal turmoil and the emotional turmoil that antidepressants have sort of erased in a lot of kids today. I mean, I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but maybe we can look at sort of this downhill progression that we've seen certainly since the grunge explosion, where rock and roll was less and less a part of most kids' experience, less and less kids are interested in playing it. You know, it's not like when I was young where rock and roll was it. That was youth culture. You know, square one, front and center. Maybe it's true. I mean, maybe all these psychotropic pharmaceuticals that have sort of dulled the same impulses that might lead to depression but can also lead to immense creativity. You know, Kurt Cobain maybe is a great example of this. And it's maybe the fact that he is sort of the end piece on this particular expression of rock and roll, at least how I see it, that I see Nirvana is sort of the end game, you know, where they were bringing this much more orphic, more defeatist, more self-involved energy into the music with grunge and whatnot. The personal pronouns become, you know, 90% of the lyrics. Maybe there is that sense, you know, that maybe a lot of these artists who we see as being self-destructive, Jim Morrison or whatever, you know, maybe that would have happened anyway. You know, luckily they had music to let all of this out before they self-destructed. You know,
well, it's kind of interesting, too, just because, like, the antidepressants, I mean, they kind of do the opposite of most musicians' drugs of choice, which are depressants, right? I mean, most musicians get involved with depressant drugs. I mean, not all, obviously. There's all the, you know, cocaine and fun stuff like that, but a lot of that kind of melancholic music tends to come out of depressant drugs instead of, like, the other antidepressant end. So I think, I mean, that's kind of interesting, too.
Well, when you look back at the old, the Greeks understood this. Walter Burkert, who's one of the great students in the mysteries, talks about how Persephone is picking Narcissus flowers. And Narcissus flowers had a narcotic property to them, and that the descent into the underworld is really the descent into that sort of that dark night of the soul, those depths of depression. And all the great heroes undergo this process, interestingly enough. Everybody from Hercules to Dionysus to Kybele and Attis, I mean, especially in the mystery tradition, you know, Isis rescues Osiris, Demeter rescues Persephone. There's this whole, that the rhythms of nature and the rhythms of the psyche are seen as reflections of one another, which is really a very holistic way of looking at it that we've very much lost, certainly today.
Well, I wonder if what happened is that, you know, this kind of energy, as it returns into society, and I think it's totally fair to say that, you know, it really exploded, you know, that it existed in certain kind of currents in Europe, in the developed West, before the explosion of the counterculture. You'd have, you know, certain parts of literature, certain parts of the arts, certain parts of magic, of esoteric practices and currents that go back for centuries. And then it just met this combination and created a culture of real ecstasy and of real mysteries, even if they were often erratic and kind of uncontrolled. I mean, for me, my biggest example of that is the Grateful Dead. I mean, if there was one, because it wasn't just about the band, it was about the culture that they created. And if there was a psychedelic Eleusinian mystery cult with its own symbols, its own, you know, signs, gestures, forms of dance, lore about altered states, et cetera, it was the Grateful Dead. And then, but of course, you can look at it, and it's also, in some ways, a very, you know, a kind of a tragic story, especially when you look at what happens to some of the guys in the band, et cetera. But maybe let's say that energy's moved on, that it can't sustain itself in one place anywhere. It's always moving on, but where is it? I mean, and you mentioned, of course, the living, you know, whatever, esoteric or magical religions, whether it's, you know, Santeria the forms of shamanism, which many people are interested in, are kind of reviving and transforming as the sort of global culture begins to recognize their validity. But in terms of, like, our culture, in terms of, like, the more popular culture realm, where do you see this kind of energy now? I mean, you do a blog. The blog has a lot of mysteries on it. And in a weird way, it seems like the way that information is spreading around and connections are being made these days in a way they really weren't before, that it feels like there's something on in there too, in that space as well. What do you think?
Oh, I totally agree. You know, it's sort of like the party's over for now, and we're sort of picking up the pieces and reviewing the previous night's events. You know, we had this really immense explosion of all these different energies starting after the Second World War. You know, you certainly had the Apollonian energies, and then later you had the Dionysian energies, and then maybe these sort of energies, you know, with the rise of feminism and gay rights that tie to the mysteries of Kybele and Isis and Demeter, you know, the goddess rising, these sort of things. You know, right now we have not only a host of different challenges in the economy and in the infrastructure, but we also have this information technology that needs to be used, that needs to be explored. And that, I think, is where we're going now, that is the modern expression of this. We might get to a totally different point. I mean, I'm really interested in how, and what I write, you know, almost predominantly on the blog, is how this intersection between the ideas of the mysteries and the ideas of Gnosticism express themselves in science fiction, which is a really fascinating topic. I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, Philip K. Dick was really just the tip of the iceberg. And I don't even think that he's the earliest expression of this. So I think that what is going on right now is that we're just sort of exchanging information and maybe even getting ready for the next big wave of this. You know, I'm always keeping my eye on Burning Man and sort of that whole culture, but also fan culture, pop culture, you know, these pilgrimages to all these conventions. I mean, it's so familiar to me. And, you know, when I wrote about in my first book, Our Gods Wear Spandex, how familiar cosplay, you know, costume play and conventions and all these things are to these ancient pilgrimages where people would dress up as the gods and act out their dramas and whatnot. So I think that it's almost an intermediary period but a necessary one, because we need to learn a lot more. We need to really invest ourselves more in information, because we've been very naive and innocent in a lot of ways. And I think that had to do with the derailing of the counterculture. I think a lot of people were just incredibly naive and innocent and didn't realize that this could all go very wrong.
So talk a little bit more about the Secret Sound and what you've learned. Like, what have you learned about that, how the internet, how the blog world, but particularly the way that information comes together and links form and communities form around these themes of the mysteries, of secret symbolism, of hidden initiations, of altered states, of different levels of reality. So, because it's such an interesting place, and I know you've put a lot of energy into it over the years, and you're very dedicated to it as well. I just love to hear a little bit about how you feel like your understanding of these things has changed through having a blog that has a lot of readers and has a lot of input.
What I started out doing, I'll tell you how the book started out, is that the blog started out is I had a book, Our Gods Were Spandex, and I was just, you know, I had to sort of promote it, which I was very reluctant to do on the blog. But also I had all these ideas about science fiction film that I'd been working on for a number of years that I really wanted to explore. And the great thing about doing it in the blog is that you can get feedback. You know, you throw your ideas out and people say, that's stupid, that's great. But there's also this great that they contribute. They contribute to it. There's this great interaction and all these sort of things, interactivity. It's such a cliche that was used to sort of sell this technology to us in the first place. But there is an element of truth to that. And the fact that it isn't just sitting like a monk, you know, with my quill and paper up in some monastery somewhere. I'm putting these ideas out as they happen. A lot of times an event would happen that would be just so bursting with ancient symbolism that I just would put it all out there, and these threads would just grow and grow and grow because people would be contributing and offering different ideas, and things would go in all these different tributaries and directions that you would never, ever anticipate when the germ of the idea first comes to you. And that, to me, I think there's something very important to this. There's still this sort of paranoid, there's a lot of vestigial energy from people like William Cooper and James Shelby Downard, where they were sort of, obviously to me, were people who were involved in heavy psychoanalysis. I know that Downard was institutionalized, but he was taking the tools of perhaps Jungian or Freudian dream interpretation and applying them into world events, which is in itself a very subversive thing to do. But I think there's still this sort of vestige, and actually not still. I mean, it's very much a more dominant current of, you see this a lot on YouTube and such with the Illuminati and Illuminati symbolism and all this kind of thing. And that, to me, is very much a way of people who feel disempowered sort of justifying their feelings of disempowerment by painting this grand chessboard that's stacked against them. You know, in a lot of ways, in reality, when you talk about economics and industry and things like that, that's certainly true. I think a lot of these things that we see with people like Lady Gaga and whatnot is very much an intentional distraction from the real problems. But that's a whole other story. But I think that people are really exploring this stuff, and it's a very interesting subversive process in which people who are coming to all this from a more Christian or traditional religious standpoint, or all of a sudden they're studying, you know, Manly P. Hall, or they're studying the works of Aleister Crowley, or, you know, like they're ostensibly educating themselves for this grand cosmic battle. But I think what we will see is that we're going to see an evolution where these people, the other side has got their hooks in them, and the subversive process of certainties melting away as you start to, expose yourself to more complex and strange ideas is going to be very much a part of the future, where, coming at it from this conspiratorial standpoint, but evolving into sort of almost a Discordian kind of.
Yes, it's like intentional Discordianism. It's really, it's like a hall of mirrors. I mean, what I was thinking of what you said is how it can become, you know, interest in these matters can be such a diversion and almost like you're falling into some kind of game that's designed to distract you from what's really going on. But at the same time, you know, I have a trouble with the idea that, you know, oh, then we should just be paying attention to whatever. Because if you try to understand how power works, how symbols work, how stories construct our reality, if you start to really try to understand how the world is put together in the most pragmatic terms, you're going to keep coming back to the same kinds of things. It's not like you can just leave all that aside and then just pursue the, you know, the economic conspiracies. Just to try to figure out what's going on, you have to enter into the world of media, and the world of media has its own kind of logic. So it seems like one way or another, we have to learn how to navigate these networks of correspondences and synchronicities that seem to be almost inherent in a networked world. Whether you think about it in terms of just the way information works, or whether you think there's some kind of, you know, a cosmic principle that's at work between these sort of hidden connections.
I absolutely agree with you, and I do agree with you. It's maybe a question of degree, but really, what I think ultimately this is about is that we're undergoing an evolutionary process where at one point we were relegated to a very basic form of literal communication, and that was the lingua franca. You know, literalism, the literal word, is really the highest ideal. And this very interesting process that I'm talking about, this subversive process where people are entering into this mystery of symbolism and correspondence with the intention that they are somehow fighting against it, but they find themselves being infected by it. They find themselves being part of the game, you know. But that is the drama of it. You know, in order to sell this process, you need the drama, you need the narrative. But ultimately what we were, you know, progressing to is a much more holistic concept of communication. The communication isn't just about words. Communication is about symbolism. It's about visual cues that most people ignore. I mean, there's a show called Lie to Me that I'm fascinated by because it's all about this guy who reads body language to solve crimes. You know, all these forms of nonverbal communication are sort of welling back up. And this is something that people understood a long time ago. Certainly in Asian cultures was very much a part of their experience as well. I think that this is something that we are moving towards. We will transcend the drama, but we will understand. And it's going to be a very interesting process because a lot of people are going to be inoculating themselves against the powers of advertising and the powers of persuasion and symbolism. And this is something that I've been doing a lot of on The Secret Sun, is, you know, showing you that this isn't just about, you know, these music videos, that there are powers that are doing this to you, you know, particularly religious powers. I've had a series called The Secret War Against the New Age, which sort of is showing how other forms of communication are being used to sort of create scapegoats and patsies for what's really going on. You know, we are going to evolve. We're going to be a lot harder to fool, I think, as a species if this process continues. So, I mean, that's what to me is very exciting. You know, we sort of, everybody enters into the narrative, the drama, you know, when they first confront this material. And, you know, and that I went through it myself. Everyone does it because when you enter from a literal frame of mind into a more complex and holistic frame of mind, first of all, you're going to feel threatened by it because something's been going on without your knowledge. But second of all, you know, you're going to feel sort of feelings of inadequacy, and I think that's where it sort of feeds into this conspiracy mindset about this, that, you know, people feel inadequate. They feel that the rug's been pulled over their eyes, as it were. But I really do feel like, to me it's a very positive and exciting thing, and it's part of technology and whatnot, that we are going to move to a much more rich and complex form of cultural expression than we've had in the past 2,000 or so years.
Well, that's a good vision. I'm enjoying that. I mean, what do you feel like we only got a couple of minutes left here, but just like maybe a final statement from you that what is it that you're trying to do to facilitate that? Like, how are you trying to avoid the traps of conspiracy of kind of shutting down and really be prepared and kind of contributing to that shift?
Well, I'm not necessarily trying to, I have a basically a conspiratorial mindset myself. It's just, who are the players and who are the victims is I sort of differ maybe to what the mainstream thought is there. But what I'm trying to contribute is I'm trying to show that, we've had a very rich and diverse and strange and weird cultural history that's been taken away from us, that's been hidden away from us. That we have almost, it sounds kind of ridiculous to say so, but there's almost this nascent superpower that we can begin to work towards a more holistic form of communication where all of the horses are in play, not just literal language. And that's very much a part of what I'm doing. But I'm also trying to explore Gnostic ideas as well. Because I think the Gnostics, as much as they were sort of looked down upon and they've been ridiculed, I think they had a much more avant-garde view of the way the world works than their competitors did. I think maybe they
I like that. I also like the way you introduced this enormous topic of Gnosticism with like 45 seconds to go. So clearly we're going to have you back at some point on Expanding Mind. But Christopher Knowles wanted to thanks you again for joining us and Expanding Mind. Maja says goodbye as well, though her phone died, so we're only in chat communication at the moment. That's why she disappeared. And once again, people, check out Christopher's blog, The Secret Sun, and his new book, The Secret History of Rock and Roll. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you, Eric.